Welcome to the Traditional Arts Indiana podcast, featuring interviews with craftspeople and artists from our residency series at the Mathers Museum of World Cultures. I'm your host, Maria Zarang. In this episode, John Kay, Director of Traditional Arts Indiana, speaks with potter Tom Winsack. We hope you enjoy this interview, recorded as part of Indiana University's semester programming.
I want to welcome you all to the Mathers Museum of World Cultures. My name is John Kay. I'm the curator of folklife and cultural heritage here. And I'm also a professor in the Department of Folklore. And we're having a course here on the beauty of Indiana folk art. Could be easily just the beauty of folk art. And we're trying to decide who are the folk, what is art, what makes it beautiful or not so beautiful. What does it mean to be Indiana? Do you have to be born here? Can it be something that's brought from someplace else? All types of topics. And so about every week this semester, I've got an artist or two coming to visit with us. And we're recording this session here as part of a podcast that we'll be hosting on the beauty of folk art as well. I'm really pleased to have with us Tom Winsack. Did I say your last name right, Tom?
Winsack.
Winsack, okay. Tom Winsack from down in New Harmony, near New Harmony, down Posey County, we'll say it that way. He does beautiful redware pottery, as well as beautiful stoneware pottery. And I have to say, my job as a folklorist, I go to artist studios all over the state of Indiana, and I can honestly say you've got one of the top two studios of any of the artists I've gone to visit. So
thank you, John.
Maybe before we even get started, why don't you tell us kind of who you are and where you work? Tell us about the place.
I'm really fortunate. About 30 years ago, my wife and I were living in Indianapolis, and I was actually a business major in college, so I was in the business world. But we wanted to live in the country. She grew up, she was a farm girl, but we both liked country. We liked being in the woods. And we had an opportunity in Posey County, which is a very southwestern county in Indiana. It's bordered by the Wabash River and the Ohio. And she had a great aunt and uncle that were elderly, and they had 80 acres of farmland that was close to where her father and brothers farmed. And we had the opportunity to buy it, but we were in our mid-20s, and 80 acres of farmland was even pretty expensive then. So it was kind of a dream that we thought we could do it, but we couldn't do it. Well, her dad came up with the idea that he would buy the actual farm property. His name was Ed Dregge, and good German name. And he and her brothers bought the acreage of farmland, tillable farmland, and then we could afford the 14 acres of a little bit of pasture and mostly wooded property. But it also had a barn from 1890 along with a farmhouse on it. And so we bought all of that 14 acres lock, stock, and barrel. It came with a tractor and a hay wagon and everything. So, and it's rural Posey County. It's a really beautiful place. It's we live in you have to go about a half mile down a private lane through a woods to get there. And at the time, I was still in the business world, and I took a job with Hertz Car Rental at the Evansville Airport. And I managed that facility for 23 years and just dabbled in doing different things with my hands. I did stained glass, I did some wood carving, just really loved working with my hands, but I also collected historic pottery. And I had an opportunity to take a class through USI, and it was a continuing education class on pottery. So, long story short, I took it. I loved doing the pottery. And so not only did I appreciate how it was made, but I started doing the research and teaching myself about historic forms of pottery and different types of glazes. Fast forward about 10 years from that, we found out that her dad had taken down a log barn, a dog trot style barn, in the 1960s and stored all the logs in a different barn that was protected from the weather. Well, my wife said, you should build a studio out of that. So we did. We took those logs and we actually went around to different log buildings around the state, historic sites, to see what people did. And basically they did what they had to do. So, you know, you kind of, you just put up the logs and you just do what you need to do. So we thought we can do this, and we did. We did all the work, and there's a picture out that I'm, if you noticed it, that I brought of my studio. And if you haven't, when you go back out there, it's on an easel out there. It's really a wonderful place to work. The logs were felled in what we think is about 1850. There's some great big 19, 20-inch poplar logs that were involved in it. There's some hickory. So we put a section of that back together to make the studio, along with building out a section for kilns. I also used the 1890 barn as a glazing area. And over the years, John didn't see this, but I did some research on historic bread ovens from Quebec. And so I built a bread oven out of clay soil on our property. So we bake sourdough bread about every 2 weeks, and then we also use it for wood-fired pizzas. So we also, when we redid the barn 4 years ago, we had some Amish men come and actually lift the barn up and restore it. So when we did that, we keep a dining room table that I made out there, a rustic table that I made from the old barn wood that they took off. And we use that to have pizza parties. So you all, if you're ever down there, give me 3 hours notice to make the dough, and we can have pizza. So that's where I work. I mean, we live in a log home, too, that we built. So I walk from my log home past the 1890 barn to the 1850 log studio, surrounded by gardens. And I have to tell you, it's probably the best thing. And I've forgotten about the business world pretty fast. So I've been doing pottery full-time for about 10 years now. And it seems like a whole different life. But this is where I belong. I'm glad it happened this way. And it was the right path. And for some reason, it worked.
That's fantastic. It's working for me here. It's true that a lot of your pottery is inspired by different historical potteries and historical potters at time. But probably one of the more significant to southern Indiana and to Posey County, where you live, is the Harmonist community. Can you tell us just real briefly about who were the Harmonists? How did you become familiar with the Harmonist style of pottery? And what is that like?
Yeah, the Harmonists came from Wurttemberg, Germany in 1804. They settled in Harmony, Pennsylvania. They lived there for 10 years and were a very industrious society. They were celibate like the Shakers, very similar. They had a strong religious leader by the name of George Rapp. But they wanted a more open marketplace. So they were looking for a place down the Ohio River that they could actually use a paddle boat to ship their items from down the Wabash to the Ohio all the way down to New Orleans, which they were actually doing. They were great German brewmasters. They made wine and also wonderful textiles of the period. Their woolens were supposed to be some of the finest woolens in the country at that time. They were some of the first people to use merino sheep in this country, which was a real soft, long-haired wool. So their textiles were well known. So they were selling in Shawneetown, Illinois, which was a good trading post, and all the way to New Orleans, like I said. Well, Christoph Weber was the society's potter, and he came from Germany with them, and that was in 1814. So out of the Indiana wilderness, they built this beautiful town along the Wabash River. If you've never been to New Harmony, I would recommend it. It's unlike any other historic town that I can describe. There's not even a grocery store. It's very uncommercial, we'll say. It was worked and reworked by the Harmonists for 10 years. They left behind some beautiful buildings, but they realized the economic forces were still back east. So in 1824, they sold the town to a Scottish industrialist by the name of Owen, and he wanted to develop a utopian society. So the Harmonists, they went back to a place near Pittsburgh called Economy, Pennsylvania, and that's another interesting place if you all want to visit. But the town then became a knowledgeable society. Owen brought very knowledgeable people from the East Coast. The U.S. Geological Survey started in New Harmony, Indiana. Thomas Say, if you know that name, is buried there. There were different artists that came from Europe and sketched. So it became a very interesting place. But like any utopian societies, there weren't enough worker bees. And in about a year and a half, it fell apart because the people were starving. So it just kind of fell apart. So, but there's so many beautiful things about New Harmony that were left behind. It's really kind of a little artist, spiritual community that you still feel different when you're there.
And they've been excavating the Potter's kiln site down there, and you've been kind of involved at least in a roundabout way with that process. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Mike Strushevsky from University of Southern Indiana is an anthropologist and an archaeologist, and he was working with the State Museum in Indianapolis. And they actually, for several years, they were looking for the actual kiln site, and they did find it. I think it might be going on 3 years ago now. It seems like time flies for me. But it is, half of it is buried under another historic building that many years later was kind of plopped down on that site, so they can't do any more research to get underneath it. But they really did find the actual kiln site of Christoph Weber. And what I think is interesting, and some of you heard me talk about redware out there, I brought some examples. Is it all right if I pass those around? There's some interesting things. We'll get these two things going first. We'll start with you since you all. So the little yellow round thing, if you just hold that up just for a second, you can see the color of this thing wherever you are. And you notice it's not red in color. Well, that's raw clay that we have on our property. And this was the type of clay that the Harmonists were making bricks out of. So if you think of bricks as red color, you think, well, wait a minute, that's yellow. Well, what happens with redware is redware gets its name from the fired or finished product and not necessarily the raw clay. So believe it or not, there's enough iron oxide in this yellow clay that when you fire it to about 1900 degrees, it starts to turn orangish red and it becomes brick colored. And the second little square tile that's coming around with that, if you turn it over and look at the unshiny side, that's brick colored. And the other side has that reddish brown color, and that's the side that's been glazed. So that's a good kind of a step up for redware. So redware was taking the basic clays closest to the surface of the earth and making pottery out of it. And that's why redware from Maine to Illinois down to North Carolina, all over the United States, looks the same no matter what the red clay or what the raw clay looked like in the area. And I also brought this too, and I'll pass this around, and I think this is really interesting because this is a mud dauber's nest, okay? And we all know that mud daubers don't go digging clay. They're surface scavengers for clay. Well, our soil, when you look at it, is not reddish brown in southern Indiana. It's yellow. So I'll pass this around and you can all look at it, but this was fired to just about 1700 degrees. If I glazed this and fired it, it would look like a piece of redware pottery. So, and the backside of this has wood grain on it. That's our chicken house. That's where the mud dauber was stuck to the chicken house and we knocked it off. So I just think it's interesting. So anyway, that's what redware was, and that's what Christoph Weber was making.
That's great. One of the things I'm really interested in this whole idea of folk art or material culture in general is the fact that every object carries with it the kind of mind of the maker, you might say. You can look at something that has been made hundreds of years ago, and if you have enough knowledge, you can start deconstructing some of the techniques, what the artists actually took care about, what they didn't care about, in the ways that they made something and finished something. So back to the harmonist, Redware, you actually took some fragments, didn't you, from the kiln site and started learning from them.
I did. What Mike did is he gave me pieces and he said, you know, I don't know what this is. What do you think it was? And just from my research and knowledge, I could look at a piece and say, oh, I think that was this. I've seen pieces like that. It's a colander, or that would have been a bowl with a 12-inch rim, because you could kind of put a segment of a piece of pottery down on paper and kind of trace it out, and you can see how big the bowl was or how thick it was. If it was a small bowl for just serving, you know, maybe a cereal-type product in, or if it was a large, thick bowl for dough mixing or something. So what Mike did is he gave me several pieces, and I developed the pieces for him. And he made a nice display of the sherds of pottery and then what a full harmonist piece would look like. And that was really a nice opportunity for me also to imagine Christoph Weber and to channel him. And the glaze that he used too, to try to get the color right. So, because he was using lead glazes. I mean, there's no getting away from that from the time period. Lead was actually a beautiful glaze. I mean, it melted at the right temperature. It was shiny. It was thick. It was pretty. But you know, they didn't realize it was deadly or toxic when you're using it, leaching into the food. They realized that people that worked around lead had problems, so they were somewhat careful. But you know, today, if you've ever done pottery, what we do is we put the dry glazes in water, and then you kind of mix them up, and then you dip the pieces in so the dust stays down. Well, they usually would have apprentices that were just, they would have a plate, and they would just kind of sift the mixture of sand and lead dry on the piece. And you can imagine, okay, so they're, you know, think of sifting flour, you know, or so you're sifting lead all day long. And you're not only breathing that, but think of the floor then. So every time you're walking and your clothes, so you're exposed to lead your whole life. And they really think that Christoph Weber died. He did go back to Pennsylvania, but they think that he went mad as a result of lead poisoning, and then that broke down in his system, and he died because of it. So It was dangerous. So I don't use lead in my glazes. I use a very food-friendly glaze, so I don't kill anybody, including me.
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about the technique of the work that you do. You have a variety of tools that you've brought with you here, and they look like a combination of found objects and wood shop projects and little pottery pieces. Can you tell us what those are and what they do?
Sure. Well, you know, in the time period, you couldn't go to the pottery store, so you used what you had. And potters learned through an apprentice program and then a journeyman process, and they became a master potter. And I don't know if you know the journeyman story is that once you're an apprentice, like for me, and if John was a potter, then they would go to another village and maybe work with John. So they go on a journey, and that's where the term journeyman comes from. So you might go to one, two, three different potters, but you're picking up, you know, master techniques, because everybody picks up little tricks regardless. So, you know, you might find, oh, that tool works good in this place. Oh, look at what this potter's doing. So then at the end of that, you become a master potter, and then you take on apprentices. So anyway, some of the tools, this is a clay cup that's actually thrown on the wheel, and found objects, they would have had turkeys. This is a turkey quill. The quills were used a lot in not only writing, but potters used it. So it's hollow, so it acts like a delivery system. And some of you earlier saw me put that liquid clay, or what we call slip, in here. And so as you tilt this, you can actually write or you make designs, and it's called slip trailing because the slip, the wet clay, is trailing out of the turkey quill. So that was this was one of the primary tools that Christoph Weber was decorating with, and he was a master at it. And I have to tell you, if you look at my little design out there, I just wrote the word pie on a plate, and there's drips and drizzles. Well, he did some masterful things with beautiful little squiggles that are so even, and not only on the top flat rims, but on the sides of bowls. And you think, that's absolutely incredible, because the bowl would have been wet for the clay to stick to when he was doing it. So you can't pick up a big bowl while it's wet, tilt it on its side, and then twist it and make the clay. So he was very masterful at it. So even though it seems like a simple decorating technique, I have tremendous respect for potters of that period and some of the things that I see. Other potters, not so much. They probably, the apprentices were doing some funny squiggly things that aren't even and things, but he was doing that. Another tool that was typical of the period, you can all come up here later and actually see the details of these, but this is called a coggle wheel. And the coggle wheel was to run along the edge of the pot for a couple different reasons. It gives it a nice decorative edge. It's hand-carved maple, so it's a hard wood. And it rolls, so you can just roll it around. But also, some of you saw my wood-fired pieces. Well, when you're wood-firing, the ash is going through the kiln and sometimes settling on pieces. Well, they didn't want the ash to settle on the nice plates or the designs that they had, so sometimes they would not glaze that rim. This coggled edge would give enough airspace so they could put rim to rim, so if there was any ash that fell on the plates, it fell on the backside of the plate. So, it didn't hurt the decoration. So that's called a coggle wheel. And then I just used, the different turkey feathers. And also some of you saw me carving out there on the plate. And this is just a little piece of tin that's shaped like a shovel. And it has chicken feathers on the opposite side. And it's not just for decoration to look period. Because I'm carving when the clay is somewhat damp, those little shavings coming off sit in there. If I took my hand, I would smudge the wet clay onto the clay or the damp clay. So the chicken feathers create just enough air to get those off without me smudging. Another carving tool that I use are black locust spines. If you've ever seen a black locust tree, they have these incredible spines that come out the sides of the tree. Very sharp. around the cabin, my wife and I, we put pots, different flowers and things. And we have a lot of deer, too, who like our flowers. They think it's lettuce or whatever. So, but we found that if you put these in there and it just kind of pokes their nose just a little bit, that kind of keeps them from eating because they can't figure out what's poking them. So, and then the tips of the feathers, so the thick end is the part that I cut off and use as the straw for the clay to drizzle out. But this part, the thin part, is actually the part that I draw through clay to make the feathering designs that you see on the plates that I have on display, the combing or feathering. So again, it's just tools that were available. You had to be creative and, and one more tool too. Remember I talked about the coggle edge. John, if you would hold that plate up. I don't know if you can see the variation of the rim on this. This was another tool used to make a decorative edge. It's just a little scalloped shell and a seashell and just going around the edge. And it really makes a nice decorative edge, but it gives that kind of space also. So again, just a simple tool.
Very cool. And each of the tools leaves their own mark and their own history to them. You were telling me one time about your coggle wheel and the lack of perfection. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, my father-in-law, who was getting elderly after he helped us build the cabin or the studio, and he was having real trouble with his knees, and he couldn't hardly walk. And he was always an active man. So I wanted to make a historic coggle wheel. So I asked him if he would hand carve one for me, and all these little grooves are hand carved on her maple. And so it's very difficult to do to get even if you think about it. And so on here, there's one thicker place than the others, okay? And he was just distraught about it because he thought, oh, I just hate that I didn't get them all even, you know? And I said, well, you know, it's really neat. I'm going to use that one. He said, no, I'll make others for you. So he made two others that were absolutely perfect, you know, but the one that I still use is this one, because regardless if I sign my pieces of pottery anymore or not, every time I use this coggle wheel, those pieces will be attributed to me because nobody else's coggle wheel is like this. And there's some really neat things out there like that. When you look, you can attribute, as folk students of folk art, sometimes a lot of things aren't signed, but you look for those things that you can attribute to pieces, and that's one of them. So I love stuff like that. So.
That's great. When we talk about beauty, that's kind of the theme of this semester, and we have to give it a little bit of time here. When you think about your work, what do you find beautiful about it, or what do you hope other people see in it that you're trying to invest in the pieces that you make? What do you want? What makes you smile when somebody notices it?
You know, that's really hard to say, but you can tell when a piece talks or speaks to someone, and I know it's going to a good home, because some of my special pieces get kind of pricey just because they take a lot of time, and when it connects to that person, I don't know how to explain it, but they do. I see the beauty in pieces all the time. I mean, everything I try to make, you know, fairly nice and pretty, just because I know that piece of pottery is going to be around forever. Unlike other types of wooden art or textiles or whatever, pottery sherds last forever. I mean, the piece might not survive intact, but the pieces that I'm making are going to be here 1,000 years from now. And it's quite humbling when you think about that. I didn't think about that at first, because my first pieces... the pieces I didn't really like, I threw into the pond on our property. And you know, several years ago when we had a drought, and it was really a bad drought, and the pond kind of dried up, I could see those pieces sticking out of the ground. And I thought, you know, some archaeologist or student of folk art's going to come along someday and goes, boy, what a crummy potter lived here. Look at all these crummy pieces. But I hope they go, you know, above ground and, you know, find some better things. So it's just fun. I don't know how to answer that, John. I do the best I can. I try to please myself, and then when it connects with somebody, there you go. It's right. It's right.
That's great. Well, you've brought on stage here a couple of really nice pieces. Maybe the one sitting in front of you. Maybe you could do. Sometimes when someone comes to your home, you'll do like a walking tour. You'll take them and you'll walk them from room to room and tell them what it is. Can you give us kind of the walking tour of that jug there?
Yeah, this jug is based on a temperance jug in the temperance movement, late 1800s, early 1900s, where basically a women's group, they were saying our men are being torn up by alcohol. And so these jugs, actually, they showed up before a real strong temperance movement, but they started to get called temperance jugs. And so you see them with, like, men coming out of the bottles or just the snake itself. The idea was that the alcohol is good for medicinal purposes, but if you abuse it, the snake will bite you or the demons will get you, and it's your... you know, you're stuck forever in that, so beware. But temperance is a term used for anything in moderation, okay? This particular jug is kind of a play on that. Even in the time periods, there are some jugs that were called temperance jugs, but they have, like, political faces on the ends of the snakes, so they were more social comment. This was done for an exhibit this summer called Modern Craft, and it was done with, there were three other artists, a textile, a jewelry person, and a woodworker. And we were to take traditional techniques and give it a modern twist. So I took a temperance jug, and this is basically my little comment on social media, okay? So there are little, just little hints of social media on here that, you know, it's a good way to communicate, but if you're doing it so often, is it really good? Things in moderation, the whole thing. So you'll see little references on it. Of course, the apple for a spout or for a plug. The Twitter bird on top is being almost bitten by a rattlesnake. And if you think about it, it's my comment, my personal comment on Twitter and social media that we think it's free speech, but it's always going through filters. So it's not necessarily free speech, and you're not always really sure. So there are some snakes that are actually tweeting on here. The man who is stuck in the jug and trying to get out is consumed by it. He has a little book that has a face on it. Y'all get that? The backside, you see this man here who's stuck in there. He's all in. His head is gone, but look at his left hand is still like, I'm good, I like it. Okay. So although it looks like a whiskey temperance jug, and many years from now when I'm gone, somebody will probably just think that that's it, but it's just, there's just a little twist on it that's just saying something about our society as it is at this point in time. So it's fun to do things like that.
That's great. It's interesting how you've taken this historical form and you've made it very relevant. And I think your work is spans time. And I think good art often will branch beyond its immediate context, as we talked about. Let's open up to questions from the group. We've got just a few more minutes left of our session here. Any questions anybody has?
At this point, a student in the audience compliments Tom on his work and asks how Tom became so skilled at drawing. And Tom responds,
I don't know if it's something natural or something that's developed over time, but it's kind of like I've always had the mindset. I mean, each one of you, whether you're an artist or not, if you try something, you're a folk artist. I mean, I've seen some amazing primitive folk art that speaks to people, that you don't have to be a fine artist or trained at art. You just do it. Do it for yourself. And that's what I do. I do it for myself. And, you know, maybe, you know, my snakes are always getting better. In fact, you know, some of my snakes really look real, and it creeps people out, and it creeps me out sometimes. but you know, you almost want that kind of effect. That's why you're doing it. So I think if you just do it for yourself, and then you will get better, you know. So whatever it is, the Fractor that I've been doing, I found that, you know, that's the two-dimensional pen and ink and watercolor. I've never done any watercolor, nothing in my life, but what happened with that was I've been drawing these designs on plates and looking at them for 20 years and getting inspiration from the German decorative arts, that it's almost like the first one I did, it kind of flowed out of my hands, and I thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe that I made that. So I don't know how to do it. I think it's just, you just do it. You don't have to show anybody. Don't look for gratification from anybody other than you're taking a step in a new direction that, God, who knows where it's going to lead. I mean, 20 years ago, I could have never told you I'd be a full-time potter, actually making a living at this and being in this beautiful museum with you all. I mean, I would have never dreamt that. And it just pleases me to no end that you even want me here. So.
Well, we're appreciative that you've taken time out of your schedule to come spend some time with us. We've reached the end of our session here. If people don't have another question out there, let's thank Tom for coming and being with us.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you have enjoyed this podcast and will tune in for our upcoming interviews with Indiana artisans. This podcast would not be possible without the support of the National Endowment for the Arts, the Indiana Arts Commission, and Indiana University's semester program.